From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in June with the release of a report from the CDC. In that report, the center provided data on adolescent hospitalizations due to COVID-19. But according to Dr. Monica Gandhi, the CDC failed to emphasize what she said was the most troubling aspect of that study. 20% of teen hospitalizations from January through March of this year were for psychiatric emergencies, not COVID. The data, she said, pointed to a crisis. Dr. Gandhi wrote about the issue in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. In that piece, she pointed to data from experts at Stanford Children's Health Network who said that lockdowns and school closures have led to higher rates of obesity, eating disorders among young people. Elective health care visits, including those for mental health services, were unavailable in the data, but about 3 million students who may have received care from school counselors didn't attend class or didn't log in at all. Dr. Gandhi wrote, quote, "This exacerbated what the CDC has identified as a pre-existing mental health treatment gap for children in the United States," end quote. The academic year begins this week, and for many students in the region, it's the first time they will be back in the classroom full-time in the better part of 2 years. Experts say returning to full-time school will be a big adjustment for some students. So this hour, we talk about how educators and caregivers can be prepared to assist students who may have behavioral or mental health needs. Some may be struggling with substance abuse and more. There's a lot to talk about here, and I want to welcome our guest. Melissa Heatley is here. Dr. Heatley is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
In studio is the superintendent of the East High EPO, Sean Nelms, who's associate professor and interim associate dean for graduate studies at the Warner School of Education. Sean, welcome back.
Thank you.
And with us on the line is Leah Hill, clinical engagement specialist at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Hi, Leah. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm looking at headlines from across the country this week. From Iowa, from Detroit, now NPR story, a national school bus driver shortage. So we did not book this conversation this week, thinking that we were going to be talking about, frankly, an ongoing question for Rochester students on whether they're going to be back in the classroom at all and the strain that it may put on kids to be days away from finally getting back together and then being told, well, maybe not, or maybe yes, or maybe yes, but we don't know how to get you there. Rochester is not alone in this at all. And I'm not saying that to sort of cover for the district, but it's been a shock in the last few days, Superintendent Nelms, for the district to try to come up with a plan for a crisis here that affects hundreds or thousands of students, high school students primarily, with just days before the start of the school year. What's the latest that you understand?
Yeah, so I anticipated we would talk about this today, even though this wasn't the original intent of this conversation. So I did reach out to Dr. Meyer Small just to kind of get an update of where the data is as of 10:30 this morning. And she did send me a note expressing her gratitude for her team and for officials who helped to address a problem that surfaced late last week. Arguably, some would say it's always been a problem, but she has been proactive, and she has 31 elementary schools that have transportation. There'll be 10 secondary schools the kids from the Ward of Inquiry. There are a number of schools they're still rerouting, about 8 schools in total. They're looking to have that completed today. They're still in negotiations with RTS, or the public transportation system, and hoping that they will have a resolution for those students impacted. They are working diligently to support the students who have special needs, to make sure they are they're taken care of, and they will continue to communicate with students and families across the region. So that's from Dr. Meyer Smalls, a brief synopsis of what she sent me. I will say you're absolutely right. I think that there is a lot of stress, anxiety as it relates to students and the uncertainty of school reopening. I'm sure those who've watched the board meetings and seen the dialogue between the school board and the superintendent and local officials understand that everyone in that room has the same intention, and that's to open schools and get kids back in the classrooms. We all know that students are better served in the school with their peers, with the right social-emotional support that's offered by social workers and counselors and teaching staff and school staff, but also the socialization aspects. And we are gearing up to address what may occur when students come back, and those who are feeling anxious and those who perhaps have gone the last 18 months without adequate support for their mental health needs. And so school is going to be a central space for not just academics, but also the social-emotional aspects of learning that are critical. And I'm sure that, you know, the folks on the calls and Dr. Heatley will be able to expand upon some what's happening nationally and locally as it relates to student health, social-emotional health, and family health, because there are adults in the system also who, teachers who are struggling, but also parents who have struggled in the last 18 months to take care of their own health and perhaps the health of their children as well.
Sean, when did you first hear about the bus driver shortage?
I heard about it late last week.
Probably right around when most of us were hearing about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we've known that there has been a national bus shortage for quite some time. Yeah. And I have the fortunate opportunity to meet with superintendents weekly. We meet as a county. And so we've heard, you know, suburban and rural, and even a city talk about plans for potential bus shortages. It wasn't a new conversation. But I think that last week, the totality of the problem was presented, you know, for RCSD to me, you know, mid to late last week. And I think then plans began. And I think that's when we started seeing board meetings and statements from individuals around the importance of that. What I will tell you is that the RCSD and everyone involved in the situation were completely committed to finding a solution. Every kid's in the classroom. We started with, you know, how do we get every kid in the classroom in person? And we work backwards from there. And so I want to say that I don't want the impression to be that some people did not want kids back in. I think the totality of the problem just kind of hit at the worst time, which is right before school started. It left a lot of confusion for parents and for staff and for the community. And I think, you know, individuals are now in the process of trying to bring clarity to that. You know, I was fortunate at East to be able to maintain school being in person. And I'm thankful to my team for working around the clock to make sure that happened also. We have some flexibility, you know, as a power receiver to make some decisions that perhaps others can't. But the reality is we were able to be flexible because we have a lot of students at East who live in a neighborhood. So neighborhood schools has helped us. We have a lot of kids who live nearby. We have a lot of kids who are siblings, so we can put kids on the same bus. And we also have a building that can accommodate a large number of students now that our construction plan is done. So we kind of had the perfect plan in a different perspective. We had a lot of systems in place already that allow us to be fluid and flexible. But I'll say this and say this the last time. I want everyone to know that the superintendent and the state monitor, local officials all want students to be back in person. How we make that happen and how that occurs is yet to be seen, but I know there are people working around the clock to make sure that happens.
A couple more things on this, and then we're going to move on here. Thursday still looks like opening day?
Yep. So for most schools, Thursday is the opening day. There are several schools that may have to begin remote learning, and those plans will be detailed by Dr. Meyer-Small. And as RTS negotiations continue, there was a date that was mentioned last evening of the 13th for some other schools. So RTS is providing service for some schools on Thursday, but the additional schools, the schools that that right now don't have the routes finalized, I know there's a plan to aggressively get that done by the 13th.
When you read about what's going on in Iowa, Detroit, bus driver shortages everywhere, different reasons for this. Sometimes drivers are concerned about COVID. They don't feel safe. In some places, it's about leverage for contracts. So there's a lot of factors at play here. So the last question I have for you is not meant to be a loaded one. I'm genuinely curious here because I don't know the answer to this. In the middle of all of this is students.
Right.
So if this is a situation where it's about leverage for a contract, okay, you can play that card if you want. I'm not saying they did. I don't know. In this case, everything that's happening behind closed doors. But in the middle of all of this are kids. Mm-hmm. I don't know in some districts, whether it's Rochester, Des Moines, Detroit, why this is breaking so late, why some districts didn't know that this was going to crash down right in the last second. And in some cases, maybe that was by design, but transportation groups that want a better deal. I don't know. In your mind, do you feel like you understand why this happened this way?
Well, I think a national issue has There are different places have different reasons for why these things broke down. I can tell you that in Rochester, I've never heard once this being leveraged as a opportunity to negotiate a contract. I think there are some historical issues in Rochester. There's a lot of outsourcing of busing. There's several companies that you have to rely on for transportation. Again, this is something that has been a historical issue. I think, you know, the breakdown of neighborhood schools adds to the factor where you're busing kids across the county, across the city, rather. And also outside the county, too. There are some kids who are urban suburban, some kids who even go as far as Ontario for specialized services. So I think you take the totality of the problem, bus shortage, lack of neighborhood schools, reliance upon independent contractors to do this work, and then you take the pandemic and you mix all those things together, and this is where we are. So what I believe is going to happen and should happen is moving forward, how do we create an environment where we have less reliance on independent contractors? We return to neighborhood schools. We engage. We have successful schools so that parents want to go to schools within their community. And then we take some, make some strong policy changes to ensure that all those things happen. And I think that's where we're headed. Now, what happens in other areas and other communities, it might be contract related. I know in Rochester, I think it was just the result of historical and systemic issues that all hit at the wrong time. And you put a pandemic on top of that, and perhaps of drivers being nervous about COVID, and this is where we are.
But can it be solved quickly?
I don't think so. I think that I think it's going to take an enormous amount of policy work and structural operational work and detailed planning to make this happen. And again, I think as a result of this, you're going to probably see a lot of policies and structures within Rochester be reviewed and looked at to ensure that we become a little more self-reliant and be fluid enough to adjust when things occur. It's much easier to change systems in school transformation when it's your systems that you're changing. It's much harder when you rely on independent entities. And so a solution would be to really go back and look at past studies, look at past recommendations to make sure that we are focused on structural and operational changes that we can control and predict and adjust to.
You didn't spin that question. I asked you if this could be solved quickly, and you gave an honest answer. And I think everyone listening appreciates that. It's going to be hard to come up with a permanent answer. In the short term, though, are you concerned that kids aren't going to be able to get to school?
I am concerned that that patience may run out before the solution is finalized, and that's a greater concern of mine. I think, you know, we can continue to hire bus drivers. I think once some of the stimulus check money stops, people will come back to work. That's one way of getting some people back. I think as we get a better hold on the variant, people feel more safe to drive. So I think that eventually you're going to have where you have enough drivers to run the routes effectively and efficiently. I'm worried and concerned that people won't be patient enough with the system and will seek for more aggressive and rapid solutions that just may not be available.
Which people wouldn't be patient?
I think, you know, and it could be parents, it could be, you know, employees, it could be politicians, it could be a bunch of individuals. I think there's a lot of frustration in the room, but I just want to reiterate, there are a lot of people who are working hard to try to accommodate a lot of different stakeholder groups and in the short term. But I think in the long term, you know, there's going to be solutions that are made available for all of us to adjust to. There's a state monitor here for a reason to help guide some of that work. So at this point, I would say that, you know, and this is not to ignore or make an excuse for things that have happened, but I'm just asking for people to be patient as a more permanent solution is being created, because that's going to lead to long-term solutions. If we start to throw everything at a short-term solution and it creates additional long-term obstacles, that's not a solution that's viable. So my concern isn't about finding a solution. There's enough smart people in a room to do that. I think the workforce is going to come back at some point. You're going to have enough people. But we have to keep people confident and patient enough to allow people to work through this, knowing that, you know, it's going to take some time. And I know that, you know, we have a couple of months before winter hits. So when that happens, that could be even worse if we don't have a permanent solution. But for right now, we're going to focus on Thursday, focus of school opening, focus on the 13th possibly for other schools. And then we will rework these issues as they emerge. And I would just ask the community to give the school district, the school board, and Dr. Meyer Smalls some patience and some grace, you know, as they try to find a more permanent solution, because they are working hard.
Let's talk about the kids. That's what we're here to do with all three of our guests. And you heard Dr. Nelms bring up neighborhood schools. Mm-hmm. You know what the number one question I get when that term comes up? What's the difference between neighborhood and community schools?
Can so a neighborhood school would be is defined by like a geography or geographic area. So typically about 1.5 to 2 miles, a student should be attending school within that range. 1.5 miles, they can typically walk. 3 miles, they might need some busing. And so that's kind of defined by where you live. Community schools is when you bring resources like the University of Rochester to the table, and they provide a number of resources. So, for example, at East, we have a dental lab there with 2 dental chairs. We have a barbershop now. We do vision care. We have the School of Nursing with our clinic. We work with the Department of Psychiatry. I mean, so when you think about community schools, how do you bring those resources to the neighborhood school so that parents don't have to run all over the city or the county to get services? And a big part of the services that we had at East, and we embraced and expanded in the last 7 years, has been our mental health support. We realized that we have a large number of students who have adverse childhood experiences, and we have a large number of families who were struggling with students who had high levels of anxiety and trauma and depression. And so we brought to our school 2 psychiatric nurses. We brought in some other individuals to work with the students who had experienced a lot of trauma in their life. You can't like forget about your trauma. That's not how it works. You can't like take a pill and it goes away. But you can build resilience in students, and that's what we're working on at East with the help of the University of Rochester and our community partners. How do we help students and families build resilience so that they can be able to live a productive life and not let the trauma that they experienced prevent them from experiencing all that life has to offer?
And again, is it working?
Yeah, absolutely, it's working. We see students doing incredible things and reporting a sense of resilience. There are surveys for it, but you also see students doing well academically, making healthy choices, preventing drug use and teen pregnancy. But also, I think most importantly, leaning into resources. We have students requesting to meet with professionals. And I would also say that we could not do this without folks like the University of Rochester and Dr. Heatley, because these are individuals who come to us and say, hey, we have this grant, we have this opportunity, we have this free resource. How can we partner to expand the work that we're doing to benefit the students? And by that, you're supporting their families, and by that, you're supporting the community. So a healthier student leads to a healthier family, leads to a healthier community. So when you talk about universities playing a pivotal role in this work, and they become community-facing, everyone benefits, and that's what we're here to talk about today. Is to what extent can we create healthy communities?
Well, let me ask Melissa and Leah about what they see in this particular moment. I mean, with so many kids going back to school, and many kids going back to a full time school setting, classroom setting for the first time in a long time. Melissa, are you concerned for them, generally speaking, and sort of what are you seeing right now?
Well, I think we have really seen very clear increases in kids' social and emotional health needs over the course of the pandemic. There's been good data coming out that describes that over the course of school shutdowns between March of 2020 to March 2021, you saw increases in attentional and behavioral concerns that parents were reporting, that kids were reporting, and kids with neurodevelopmental disabilities and learning needs suffered the brunt of those challenges. And we saw that those challenges really decreased as schools reopened, starting towards the spring of last year. And what this has really taught us, and I think this experience has really proven something that we had suspected for a long time, is how important schools are in preventing mental health challenges in the first place, in supporting kids who may come to school with adverse childhood events and higher risk factors, and in helping our kids develop resilience over time.
When it comes to kids who maybe had very different experiences than some of their peers, were back in school a year ago this week, just about close to full time. Most of it was hybrid of some sort, but some were 2 to 3 to 4 days a week, versus kids who've been more isolated. Generally speaking, is there something that you would want parents, teachers, communities keeping in mind about kids who've come from different situations throughout this pandemic?
Yeah, so we know that many of our kids are going to be re-entering school this fall with a variety of responses. Mm-hmm. Some of those responses might look like traditional trauma responses. We might see a fight, flight, or freeze response. So fight might look like irritability, like, I don't want to go to school. I can't believe you're making me go to school. Flight might look like wanting to sleep in or putting your head down in class or wanting to skip class. Or freeze might look like feeling numb or giving blank looks to your teachers or saying to your parents, who cares about this anyway? Why should I even bother going to school anymore? And we might see this in any of our kids. And also, a good chunk of our kids are going to be doing okay. They're going to be able to tolerate the return to school. They're going to be happy to see their friends. They're going to be really happy to see their teacher or Sean Nelms walking through the halls. And really excited to be able to connect with the many rich resources that their schools are able to offer. And so we really need to be thinking about, how do we talk to our kids such that they can get through those fight, flight, or freeze responses and develop resilience from this common adverse child experience that, our kids have faced this year, and really bounce back and thrive.
Leah, there's also a concern, and I'm sure this all ties together. I don't want to bring this up as something that's distinctly different here, but tied to the concern about mental health is a concern about substance abuse, trends that we've seen in terms of sometimes teenagers, sometimes younger. And I'm curious to know what your concerns are in that regard.
Yeah, certainly. And you're right, it's not at all disconnected from the conversation that we've been engaging in currently. So it's really just a continuation. You know, a big piece of substance use holistically is also its own response to trauma, to pain, to suffering, to confusion. And so what we've seen, interestingly enough, throughout the course of the pandemic was we actually saw declines in youth across our young people, a lot of our young people being, you know, 18 and under. A big reason for that was limitations in access to different substances aside from alcohol, and that's why alcohol stayed pretty consistent through that, because it tends to be in households. So what we're anticipating coming into the fall is to essentially probably, unfortunately, get some more referrals, right? Because substance use itself is a symptom of the mental health that Dr. Heatley was just discussing. So, you know, students, young people, they'll use it as a tool to find relief. And given the stress and this collective trauma, I love how that was described, of the last year, year and a half, we can anticipate that between students attempting to navigate that from a psycho-emotional standpoint, and then being returning to a place where, you know, they have easier access to being able to get what they're looking for, we should keep our eyes peeled for the kids that are really struggling, maybe falling back, maybe getting quieter, because it is also going to be one of the stress responses that we can anticipate.
So alcohol use up among adults in the pandemic, alcohol use perhaps up among all categories, but other substances down because of access. Now kids are back together. We see more of the networks form that might, where kids might end up with substance abuse, et cetera. Anything you'd want parents to sort of be thinking about in particular about this, Leah?
Yeah, you know, I think kids will be kids, I think, to a large degree. And it's interesting with the age group. It's like we can anticipate just naturally that there's going to be some experimentation and things such as that. However, parents, I would strongly suggest to keep a close eye on whether or not they see some really distinct changes in the behavior of their child. So is my child becoming a little less social? Are their social groups changing pretty radically? Are they becoming more secretive? Are they, you know, demanding privacy? Are there really huge shifts in mood? And once again, this is not, of course, exclusive to a child using substances. This absolutely could be related to mental health. It could be related to a number of different things. However, I would definitely encourage parents to just be curious. Don't jump the gun. Be curious and ask questions. I can say from my work in the field that creating a space where we can establish safety and trust with our young people so that they know that they can come to us, ask questions, share what's going on, and feel safe and secure that they're not going to be judged as a result is going to be the best way to navigate those conversations. Keep an eye out if they're losing periods of time. You know, what have you been doing? Oh, I don't know. All right. Well, that's a little strange. And then, of course, grades. It's going to be a transition going back into person and to in-person learning. So understand that you have resources. You have resources in the community if you need it. You have resources at the schools if you need it. Of course, here at Strong Recovery, we are one of the resources in the community that specializes with adolescents and young adults. So just know that you're not alone in this and that there are pathways that you can take to get support for the family as well as that individual child.
Well, it can be very difficult, as Dr. Gandhi wrote in the Wall Street Journal, to actually measure or capture mental health sort of trends or declines, et cetera. California has tried to do that in various ways. And I just want to read a little bit about this. Again, it's one state, but I think it's a very interesting snapshot. Suicides and emergency department visits quantify only extreme outcomes, but the trends for both in California are alarming. Data from Children's Hospital of Oakland show a 66% increase in 10 to 17-year-olds screening positive for active or recent suicidal ideation in the emergency department between March and October of 2020. And they're concerned that in the last year, we don't have the full picture of the last 12 months. They're very concerned about that. They are seeing a spike in the proportion of children seeking emergency mental health services that require hospitalization immediately. That is up 75%. So that could be suicidal ideation or attempt, could be eating disorder, could be crisis for a number of things. That's up 75% year over year in Children's Hospital of San Francisco. So California is trying to quantify this, knowing that this is complex. And what they found is alarming stuff. And I'm glad that Leah brought up grades, because Dr. Nelms, I was amazed at what teachers were doing in March mm-hmm. and April of 2020, May, you know, going into a time where often, especially in high schools, you're getting ready for finals and things like that, or regents. And it was just like, hey, this is survival mode. We're going to get through the school year. Mm-hmm. We're going to help each other. We're going to support each other. Then you had a pandemic school year last September to June that was pretty different than most typical school years, mm-hmm. even though you're trying to get back on hitting your benchmarks, mm-hmm. doing the tests, et cetera. But it was different. Now you're back in person. I presume we're back to whatever is sort of normal, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And the stress that is always there is one thing for kids and testing. I imagine for kids who are maybe a little bit rusty or mm-hmm. not as in the flow, it right. can be even more so. Are you worried about that?
Yeah, like my own son, as he enters his freshman year, I think he's a little rusty. What I would say is I think there's two types of assessment, so I guess there's many, but the two I would focus on, there's assessment for learning and assessment of learning. And I think that we're at a point where we have to focus on assessment for learning, meaning that where are kids now and how can we use what we know about them to push them forward? I think the archaic way of assessment is you just kind of see where the kids are at a snapshot in time, assessment of learning, and then do nothing with it. And that's not helpful. So to have a kid come in the first 2 weeks and remind them how much they don't know serves no one any good. It stresses out the staff member, stresses out the student. So I'm much more in favor of saying, let's see where our kids are. Let's create a baseline. Let's keep the standard for, you know, the end of the year exit outcomes, and let's work toward that. And if we're good and we have a great system, even if we don't hit that benchmark, then you pass that information along to the next school year. What we typically don't see in schools, to be honest, is a vertical alignment of assessments and learning outcomes. So we don't know how kids come. We don't have a way to report when they leave and go to the next grade level. So teachers are constantly starting over. What I'm proud about East is that we created these common formative assessments where we can share the data across grade levels and among teachers so we can really track assessment for learning. That's critically important. It's also connected to our curriculum. So you heard me say this many times in this show and in public. If you don't have curriculum, you don't have assessment, then you don't have a roadmap for where kids are going. And so we're just really happy to be able to start the year having some viable curriculum and also the ability to assess where kids are and to share that data among all teachers. So my advice to school districts across the country has always been If you want to have progress, you want to help with school transformation, make sure that your curriculum is solid enough and allows you ways to assess students so you can support them. Assessments will also allow you to have a better sense of where kids are and how they're handling stress. So if you see a student who is struggling in the content area and they're excelling in another area, you get those teachers together and say, what is Johnny doing in your classroom to be successful? It may be the way in which the material is presented. It could be the type of like wait time the teacher's giving, how much patience they're giving the students, the permission for that kid to fail, like in an attempt to learn better and be, to be more courageous. They may not do well in a classroom that's very rigid and has very concrete deadlines. So the assessments will allow teachers to have communications about the kid academically, but you also pick up on some of the socio-emotional trends that kids may be non-verbally expressing, which is causing them to not be successful also. So this year for schools is going to be challenging. It's not just us transitioning kids back academically, but also assessing how ready they are to handle the rigors of school and then building a plan to help them transition and become reacclimated to a school-going culture.
Before I turn to your colleagues on the panel, Dr. Nelms, what you just described about assessment is, at least from my perspective, solely as a parent now, mm-hmm. This is the assessment for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. It's not assessment just to for the sake of it, and it is not assessment designed to try to create this competitive kind of rat race among the kids to who's going to get the best scores, right. And you know, just measuring for college entrance, all those things. Mm-hmm. You're talking about, I think, to me, a really comforting kind of assessment that says it matters. We need to know where you are. But you also, it sounds to me like you're willing to give teachers as much as you can the flexibility to say this student needs this, this student needs that. I'm not saying you eliminate testing for kids. So can you do two things for me? Just talk to me a little bit about flexibility that you want teachers to be able to have in terms of assessment, mm-hmm. but also for parents who might be on the extremes, either the parents who think it's all about testing and testing is how we know where kids are and you have to test, and the parents who think you shouldn't test at all, it's too stressful, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that debate, the latter question, that debate is about assessment of learning. Like, there are parents who say, you know, testing, if my kids do well, it gives them a leg up into college entry.
Right.
The kids who don't do well, parents are saying you're crushing their spirit and their ego and their desire to learn and to be flexible. So the of learning is, I think, important in terms of it gives you a dipstick into where the school is, but it should give you a dipstick in terms of what the school structures are, not the individual child. So I always tell teachers, if the entire fifth grade underperforms in math, it's not because we had a bad group of kids that came through. It's because our curriculum wasn't strong enough, our assessments weren't adjusted enough. It means that we lost our individual, we lost the opportunity to understand how we weren't servicing kids. So that would be an of learning. Before learning, you know, where I think most parents don't disagree with is how do we better know our students, better know our kids so they can become whatever they want to be and they can think thoughtfully and take risks and not be afraid of being ranked among their peers. And I think the of learning debate is something that was really prominent during Common Core, and the whole testing movement. I think where we're all headed back toward is having quality education so that all kids can thrive. I guess the best example I can give is if you happen to be a Browns fan, if it was an of learning experience, you would know that historically they haven't been good. But for learning, you would say we now have a quality quarterback, we have a quality receiver, and what we're going to do next based on what we learned last year about this team means they may come in second in the division.
That's a really specific analogy that I think is the first thing that you've said this hour that's somewhat wrong.
It's very hopeful.
But by the way, on that subject of kids, like, how do we rank kids against kids?
Yeah.
I remember being in high school. I had 304 kids in my graduating class. I remember kids talking about, you know, I'm 295. Yeah. I'm seventh. I mean, imagine what you are assigning almost in permanent marker on a kid's record that this is who you are. Okay, there were 300 kids. You were 298th. That's who you are in life. And that's really rough.
We create really tightly wound up students. So my daughter, I'll use my kids for an example, then I'll give it back over to other folks on the call. But my daughter, who's now a freshman at the University of Rochester, I remember it was June, second week in June, and she had to go visit a college. And she was going to miss her phys ed class. And she goes, Dad, we can't make up phys ed. I'm going to I'm going to get in trouble if I miss my phys ed class. So I go, sweetheart, second week in June, you're out of school in 2 weeks. You've already been accepted to college. Your SATs are done. It's okay to get an A minus. Like, relax. Whereas my son, who's in eighth grade, he would have been like, dude, if I got like a C or D, I'm cool with that. So, like, you know, you have those two extremes even within children. And so the way in which we as adults, you know, I would say reinforce this ranking, this importance of how you score, you know, we create additional anxiety. So imagine that tightly wound student like my daughter being off of school for 18 months and now coming back to a system where she's not the smartest one in the classroom anymore. She doesn't feel that way. Then this could lead to a lot of emotional issues. The same could be said about my son, who is naturally relaxed, who comes back and says, well, everyone's failing, so I might as well continue to fail. You can't give that permission either. So I think in the middle of all this is where mental health and academics kind of come together and try to create an environment where all kids can thrive based on where they are in the moment with a standard for where they have to go. And to the extent that we can eliminate the stress and anxiety that schools produce, we can eliminate and protect the stress that, you know, family pressure may produce and allow kids to be kids as they transition back to school and give them permission to fail in an effort to be better, we'll have better and more productive schools.
Melissa Heatley, when we think about testing anxiety and maybe this opportunity to go forward, I was going to say out of the pandemic, we're nowhere close to out of the pandemic, but whenever that happens, are there lessons that you think we should learn about the effect on kids' mental health and appropriate ways to balance?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that I heard both Leah and Sean talk about was the educators in kids' lives noticing if their grades start to slip or if they are performing out of the norm, or for parents, if they're worrying more than typical about their grades, because those can be early warning signs for mental health challenges, whether it's anxiety or just increased level of stress or depression. The U.S. Surgeon General has designated as educators as among the frontline professionals in supporting kids with mental health needs. And I think that really speaks volumes to the need for advanced training for educators and how do we support our kids who might be coming to school with anxiety or depression, and the need for increased mental health awareness for our educational staff and for parents, because those frontline folks are going to be the people who prevent those kids from getting to the emergency department in the first place.
Leah, what about you? What would you want to make sure that, whether it's parents, teachers, educators, administrators, are thinking about when it comes to balance, stress, mental health, and what we are doing as a society and frankly as sort of a school ecosystem when it comes to the weight we put on testing?
Oh, dear. I was in the classroom for 6 years before I transitioned to this work. So to all any teachers listening, man, my heart, I love you guys. You are the OGs. It is, you know, we really need to take a step back, I think, generally, you know, pandemic notwithstanding, what are our values in really raising a whole child? And what is the messaging that we're giving a child? As was mentioned, I love that example, like, hey, I'm number, you know, 395,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
And that inherent and intuitive belief, because what I can say, at least from the work that I do, so much of the patients, the young people that walk through my doors are filled with guilt, shame, remorse, anxiety, depression about who they are, who they think they're being told to be, never being good enough, those types of narratives. And there is stress absolutely related to their degree of self-efficacy in their world, and school's part of it. So given that we are still in the middle of a global pandemic, I would implore educators, parents, adults in the world who are working with any type of youth in their lives, period, family or otherwise, to remember to just take a step back and have some compassion and patience for ourselves as we try and figure out how to navigate through these continuously changing and churning times, and then being able to pass that on to our kids and let them know we know that they're doing their best. Because sometimes it's like we want them to do their best, but we want them to do what we think is their best. Mm-hmm. We can push them – we can certainly support them on their journey, but how do we grow that resilience? How do we grow that resolve? We allow them to step into their power. And that's our, I personally think that's our role, whether you're a service provider, a teacher, a clinician. How do we empower our young people to feel as though they matter and that they are whole people that are growing and they're going to do it imperfectly? So can we all just show up and show a little bit more love and kindness to one another?
Yeah, I want to read an email on the subject of how kids are feeling right now. Before I do that, I'll just say, you know, when I think back to my high school experience, I was never, ever in the running for valedictorian, salutatorian. I mean, my grades were fine. They were never great. Like, they were good. And that was fine with me. I mean, I probably could have worked harder, but I mean, I thought I worked pretty hard. But by my senior year, it's like everybody knew the top 10 who were sort of competing for it. And I'm imagining now, at my age now, thinking back, the top 10 students in the class who were just at, like, all this effort, all this mental stress. If I'm seventh, it's not as good as fifth. Or if I'm third, it's not first. They're amazing people, and they were amazing students. And they are, I can think of a bunch of them offhand. They're doing amazing things 20 plus years later, 25 years later. conversely, the students who I graduated with who were at the bottom of the class are some of the most creative people I've ever met. They are artists. They are musicians. They own interesting businesses. But what school was telling them was that they just were not worthy. And I just think there's such a risk to that. And
it's a dangerous narrative.
Yeah, it sure is. Kathy writes to say, Evan, on the subject of kids and mental health, there should be nuance on this issue, as on so many that are portrayed as either-or choices. There are over 1.5 million children in the U.S. who are routinely homeschooled. Homeschooling is not the issue. I would submit that children take their cues from their parents. And if their parents think the worst thing in the world is that their child can't go to the prom or can't play team sports or can't go to school this week, then the child will also begin to believe that. If the parents think that this is an emergency and is important to protect their community, and the way to handle a bad situation is to make the best of it and find workarounds, then that is what the children will begin to believe. Resilient adults probably teach resilience to their children, I would imagine. The problem with education during a pandemic, like so many other problems in this country, probably has more to do with poverty, having to work two jobs in an economy where essential workers are seen as dispensable, not having enough time or money to access resources for adequate online learning, etc., on one side, and an upper-class entitled mentality on the other. So while depression, mental illness, suicide, substance abuse are all devastating things to deal with, I suspect we look for a scapegoat when we are confronted with those issues. They existed pre-pandemic, and they will, unfortunately, exist post-pandemic and will continue to be widespread and cause a lot of suffering for a lot of families until our society recognizes that mental health requires widespread, available, and affordable and accessible care. That is from Kathy in Chilai. There's a lot there. Let me start with Melissa Heatley. Let's talk about the question of resilience. Kathy thinks that for the most part, if parents are saying to their kids, hey, nobody wants to deal with this, but we will, and we will get to the other side of this, and we will do it strong, and we will do it together, and you will be okay, most of those kids will be fine. Whereas if the parents think, I can't believe this is happening, this is so terrible, I'm so sorry this is all happening to you, you know, then the kid will take that cue. And that's what Kathy thinks. What do you think?
There is certainly some truth to that. There's actually been some research conducted in the past year around mental health and its correlates among kids and adolescents during the COVID-19 school closures. And one of the things that the authors found was that parents who were able to couch their messages around COVID-19 in a story of resilience and confidence that we can get through this difficult time, the more likely our kids were able to overcome any pre-existing mental health challenges and develop resilience over the course of the pandemic.
What about the concern that, you know, the extreme end of it is, and Kathy isn't saying this, but the extreme end of it is this idea that parents can just tell kids, hey, suck it up. We're going to be fine. You know, this is not traumatic.
Right.
I will tell you how to feel about this.
Right, right. Now, kids are going to feel the way that they feel, whether we tell them to or not. And so a vital part of the conversation is also accepting and validating a kid's fears or worries. You're concerned about going to school. You're a little nervous about this. And here is how I, as an adult, have coped with that. Here is why I'm confident in you and what we've taught you as parents, that you can overcome these challenges. Because if you try to use a broad paintbrush to wipe away their concerns, they're just going to have them without you. And they're going to find different ways of coping with those difficulties and concerns.
Leah Hill, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think that any teacher knows that, or parent knows that our kids can become a mirror of ourselves. And so being able to step up, once again, us as the adults in our community, we can step up and we can model for our students and our young people and our kids healthy ways. And what that is a call to action on our end to go, am I coping? Am I able to show up and hold the space and hold the compassion and patience with my child or with this young person to really acknowledge and sit with them where they're at right now, right? Because there's just, I think the pandemic, as is mentioned in the email, has stirred up a whole lot, has spotlighted a lot of deficiencies throughout our systems. But also it's kind of called a lot of us to the table to go, how am I coping? And so if I can work on some of my stuff, when I'm talking, for instance, to my niece and nephew about how they're doing, I can connect with them in a deep, meaningful way, and we can hold space together, and we can, and through that experience, we can have that shared connection. We can develop some more of that gratitude and that patience in the process. And I got a friend, I just got to say, Charles Brown, he's awesome. He goes, the marriage between gratitude and patience creates a mindful awareness of the power of resilience. And so how do we get them there? So those are my thoughts on it.
Gratitude and patience. I love that. Sean, what do you think?
No, I think, in addition to what Leah and Dr. Healy said, I think it's also taught us about ourselves, but also how important it is for us as institutions and systems to work together. So I would say, previous to this, there were probably very informal connections between universities and medical centers and schools. They were kind of school-based dependent and relational dependent. I think what the pandemic has taught us is that we have to be intentional in how we connect and share resources. And I can tell you that prior to the pandemic, Melissa and I were probably on a dozen emails a year. Since the pandemic, we're probably on a dozen emails per week with her and her team, sharing ideas, sharing information, sharing research, so that when we come back to school, we're better informed about what's not just what's happening here in Rochester, but what's happening nationally. And we keep checking in. So I applaud the University of Rochester and its various departments for leaning in and making resources available and making sure that we're being proactive in how we support families as we transition back to school.
You want to add to that?
Yeah, I think Sean really hit the nail on the head. The pandemic has opened a lot of opportunity for really diverse systems to come together to support our kids. And to that end, we were really excited this morning to find that we were awarded a national federal grant to support mental health awareness training by SAMHSA. And we're starting a project called You Are Supporting Our Students, which is going to be held over the next 5 years in the Finger Lakes region, including Rochester City School District, Monroe County, and 8 counties in the surrounding area, focused on training high school educators and mental health teams on how to support adolescents with serious mental illness. We're going to be conducting youth mental health first aid trainings and hosting panels and really focusing in on how do we train our frontline staff, our educators who are interfacing with students on a day-to-day basis, not how to be therapists, but how to recognize, approach, refer, and support our kids before they need emergency room visits. And we're very, very excited to be able to partner with East High School and with Rochester City and Monroe County and other surrounding counties to do this work.
That's great. Wonderful stuff. Well, as we get ready to close, this is my chance to ask Superintendent Nelms just briefly, beyond kids back in the classroom, a big part of school life is art, music, theater, sports. And we've heard a number of listeners on this program say, hey, let's get kids back in schools, but pre-vaccines under the age of 12, no sports, no theater, no music, just keep, do the academics.
And I, first thing I actually thought about was the mental health impact, possibly, on what do you think of that?
I would say that kids weren't surveyed.
Kids weren't surveyed.
I could say we had a football game last weekend. East came out victorious and 45-0. Shameless plug. And I would tell you that every kid and every parent of a kid in the stands were cheering and happy and supporting their youth. And arts and music and sports and clubs are critically essential. In schools, academics are not just about, you know, the four core subjects. It's really the whole child. I think Leah said it earlier, how committed are we to educating the whole child? And giving them artistic outlets is critically as important as English, math, social studies, and science. So I would say that I respect the opinion of those who may think keeping schools closed from those activities are important. But I would tell you, as an educator, what students have cried about and written about and spoken about most, unfortunately, is not math, science, social studies, English. It's how do we connect with our peers in a very productive and healthy way? And those are opportunities for kids to do just that.
Am I going to be able to get back on stage? Are we going to be able to perform?
Yep.
Can I sing with the choir again? Mm-hmm. Can we play?
Yep.
45-0, by the way.
Yeah. You know.
You got Stephon Diggs kids at your school? What's going on? Sean always takes his time to get his plugs in. I know these are serious challenges for our kids. And I know that all three of our guests view so many of the kids that are not their own biological children. I mean, they are thinking about our kids in this community as one big connected community, and we are grateful for that. Superintendent Elms, good luck, and let's stay in touch. I know there's a lot sort of in flux here. I hope your kids have a great start to the school year.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And our thanks to Dr. Melissa Heatley, professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thank you for your expertise.
Thank you.
And Leah Hill, clinical engagement specialist at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thank you, Leah.
Thank you so much.
All right, more connections coming up in a moment.